thanks. So today I'd like to tell you about how to realize some phases which people have been interested in the last few years in microscopic Hamiltonians, and in particular in SU2 invariant Heisenberg Hamiltonians. So this talk really has got two parts. One is a very general overview, which is going to be familiar to most people, but not at all familiar to some here, about what kind of phases people like to think about these days as exotic phases. And then the second part is going to be a relatively technical part on how to realize them. Okay, so firstly, examples of topological phases. Well, several of them are very well known, so most prominently the quantum Hall. So what's a topological phase? I think it's probably fair to say that at the moment this to some extent depends on who you ask. But I think perhaps the minimal definition is that it's some phase which is distinct from a high-temperature disordered phase which has no local order parameter, or some aspect of which is not described by local order parameter. So most prominent one is the fractional quantum Hall effect, where you get these phenomena here. So charge fractionalization, quantization of Hall connectivity and edge states, all of which are related in a rather intricate way. The cases I'm going to be talking about today stem from an older interest of mine in RVP liquids, and again you have fractionalization of quantum numbers and potential relevance to correlate electrons again. And then if I have time in the end, I'm going to talk a little bit about different types of spin liquids on the pyroclore lattice, which is shown here. But the main thrust of the talk is going to be how to realize these kind of singlet based exotic phases. Okay, so the phases of interest I'm going to address in some more detail here. Topological RVB liquids, about which I'll say a few words in the general introduction. Particular flavor of deconfinement that you get even in low dimensions. Another type of spin liquid called a U1 Coulomb liquid in higher dimensions, and then a number of solid phases parasitically also exists. So where do these things come from? So a lot of the interest stems from correlated electrons. As I've mentioned, there was quantum Hall physics, high-temperature superconductivity. And then also there's been very intense interest in the field of frustrated magnetism. This talk is going to center around Roxak-Kivelson quantum dimer models, which the Hamiltonian for which I'm going to give in a few slides, which really mainly, I think, due to their analytical tractability, have proven very useful in making progress on this front. So the basic question I'm going to be asking here is, given an SU2, can I find an SU2 invariant Hamiltonian, which I'm going to be able to use to construct models which realize these phenomena? So the way I'd like you to understand this approach is that I'm not going to tell you a Hamiltonian which you can then rush off and build even in your immensely tunable cold atomic systems, but what I'd like to give you is some motivation for having confidence in that these phases actually exist and are therefore worth looking for. So I'm trying to answer really in an, what I'm trying to give you is an analytical approach to start from some degrees of freedom that we like and end up with low energy, low temperature states which look like this. And what actually is the simplest way of realizing them is something that probably this approach is not going to tell you about, but at least it's more or less purely analytical, and therefore there's relatively little of these systematic uncertainties that you get when you study, for example, exact diagonalizations in two dimensions or even in three dimensions. So the route I'm going to be taking is one which was which builds on an insight by Klein, who wrote down Klein models, and which was then taken further a few years ago by Chase and Kivelson, and we've more or less taken this program a lot closer to its conclusion. Collaborators, I'm going to write a few references on the board in a second. Main ones for this part of the work is Kumar Raman, who is now in Urbana-Champaign and Shivaji Sondi. For actually finding some of these weird phases, there are lots of collaborators. So for example, David Hughes, Eduardo Fradkin, Vadim Oganessian were very important in this most non-trivial example. Okay. So I'm going to start things a bit backwards by giving you lots of results, just to make sure that people don't get lost along the way in too much detail. And I'm first going to basically write down a particular quantum dimer Hamiltonian, which the rest of the talk is going to be devoted towards deriving in a controlled way, and then telling you some results that you obtain using it. So the important thing about the quantum dimer Hamiltonian is that you don't write down an effective Hamiltonian for spins, but rather you write down an effective Hamiltonian for different low energy degrees of freedom. And these are dimers here, and what exactly the dimer means is going to be something that's going to become clear in the remainder of the talk. But most simply, you can think of it as a singlet bond between two sides. And the important thing that's going to determine a lot of the structure of what we see is the fact that this is an extended degree of freedom, and the fact that it's an extended degree of freedom which lives on links naturally already indicates to you why there are going to be connections to gauge theories, because in gauge theories also the effective degrees of freedom like to live in links, the gauge fields. Okay, so there are two terms in this quantum dimer Hamiltonian. The one is called the kinetic term. It basically takes on a given plaquette where two dimers point one particular way. There's a resonance which gives them the other allowed configuration. So notice again, this is not a single site operator. It's something which acts in a plaquette. And again, this is something that comes out very naturally when you think about gauge theories. This is sort of a plaquette term, sort of like sigma z around a plaquette. And so this is one term. This is the kinetic term, also known as the resonance term. And I'm not going to go into the origins of this, but the reason these kind of liquids are called resonating valence bond liquids is basically because you can think of the singlet you can call a valence bond, and this is the basic resonance move, which is perhaps more familiar from hexagonal plaquette, where you recognize it as the basic structure which gives you the fundamental quantum chemistry of benzene, where you have different pairings of electrons around the hexagonal ring. So this is what motivated Phil Anderson to call this thing a resonating valence bond model. The other term is a potential term. I'll show you how this potential term arises, but you can simply think of this as a term which counts the number of plaquettes which can have this resonance, which can participate in resonances like this. So technically the reason you introduce something like that is because it's a very nice way of increasing the strength of quantum fluctuations. It turns out in a certain sense the system has its most strong quantum fluctuations when this term equals, and when the amplitude of this term equals the amplitude of that term. This is known as the Roxak-Hilleson point. And a lot of the progress that's been made is due to the fact that at the Roxak-Hilleson point you can analyze these models in a lot of detail, thanks to a phenomenon which one might call dimensional reduction, that a quantum model actually starts behaving like a classical model.
Question.
Yeah?
I agree with your statement that when V equals T, probably quantum fluctuations are strongest. Mm. But naively, if one were to just look at the Hamiltonian and sort of forget about the Hilbert space, wouldn't the V equals zero point naively have pretty strong quantum fluctuations as well?
Well, since I haven't given you a definition of what I mean by strong quantum fluctuations, I'm not quite sure that I can give a particularly clear answer to that. I think, I mean, as you know very well, the wave function is completely delocalized on the space of throughout Hilbert space here, which I think is not an unreasonable way of saying that quantum fluctuations are strongest. I mean, this is obviously a basis-dependent statement. It was more intended of giving people an idea of why one does that rather than make a particularly precise point. If you look at a single plaquette, obviously, you see what happens. Okay. So let's just have a look at the phases we see here, and I'm going to try to... One which is particularly important is this liquid phase. The reason this is particularly important is because it is a liquid phase, and I'm going to tell you a few of the strange properties of that. So generically what you get are these kind of solid phases. Here you see the dimers and the square lattice have a tendency to line up nicely and form this what's known as a valence bond solid. Here it's a staggered valence bond solid. Again, there's broken translational order, broken translational symmetry, and similar phases appear here in the on the triangular lattice, but there turns out to be one phase which does happen to have a does happen to represent a topological liquid. And after this phase was proposed, there were a lot of people saying, well, okay, this is great, but do you actually get this out of an SU2 invariant spin Hamiltonian? Because clearly this thing is not SU2 invariant. And what this talk is about in large part is to show how to connect this kind of effective quantum diamond model to an SU2 invariant Hamiltonian. Yeah?
What do you mean about this Hamiltonian in the triangular lattice?
Okay, so in the triangular lattice, so the important thing is that there are no single diamond moves and that you have to have Plaquet resonance terms. So if you take a Plaquet like this, which is a rhombus, and you have a dimer which goes like that, then it gets replaced by a dimer which looks like that. Okay. Right, and so you can define this on any lattice. This thing gets replaced by the shortest Plaquet, which has an even number of sides. So on the hexagonal lattice, it would be A. This is exactly this benzene type Plaquet on the hexagonal lattice. Okay, so let me just tell you about two of the most intriguing properties of this kind of liquid phase. So one is known as quantum number fractionalization, and so since the basic degree of freedom, which I'm asking you to think about for the moment as a singlet bond, is a dimer between two sides, imagine knocking out an electron from one side and what's left behind is a hole. But then since nothing has happened to that side, but there was something there before, but the dimer is gone, what you're left with is one spin, which is now missing its partner with which it had its singlet bond. So think about having a dimer here, knocking out this electron, you're left with a hole and a spin. And now you can try to separate the two from one another, and then the question is, can you separate them at a finite cost and energy? So if you've got a liquid of dimers, basically you can think of moving this hole away till it's a large distance away, and then what you find is that since the liquid has a finite correlation length, once there's a finite distance between the two, it doesn't cost any additional energy to move them even further apart from one another. So you see that an electron, which has got quantum numbers of spin a half and charge E, has fractionalized into something in a hole on which has got a charge but no spin, and a spin on which has got a spin and no charge. So this is a generic property of these kind of liquids. And just to show you how these things go wrong in other cases is if you'd had this kind of valence bond solid where all the dimers line up like this, you do the same thing, you knock out this electron, you move the spin away, then you see that this regular row of dimers now has a defect here. And in other words, that costs you an energy which grows as you increase, because basically the number of defect dimers as you move this thing away gets larger and larger. Okay, so that was the first thing, liquidity and fractionalization. The other thing, which is, again, going to be very familiar to most people here, is topological order. The nice thing here is that this is perhaps the simplest picture I can give of topological order. So topological order, and there have been several talks on this in this workshop here already, occurs in the surface of non-trivial topology, for example, a cylinder. I've plotted a cylinder here, and topology is, of course, non-trivial, because you can take a loop around here which is non-contractible. So you can't shrink it to zero without doing some violence to it. What you can then define is the winding parity with respect to a cut, with respect to this particular cut. So think of this loop. So think of this cylinder as harboring a triangular lattice. So I've now shown you a flattened version of this. So think of this cut as going all the way around the cylinder, and then you count how many dimers cross this cut, and you see in this particular case it's 5, and so you notice that 5 is an odd number. And then you ask which states are dynamically connected to this particular state, and what you see is that you can only change the number of dimers crossing this cut by an even number. This is precisely due to this dynamical constraint here. You can remove 2 dimers so that the blue ones here lie on the dashed red lines, but you can never remove a single dimer by local moves. That is to say, whether or not you're in an even or an odd state. The even and the odd sectors of this theory don't communicate with one another. So, in other words, whether or not you're in an even or an odd state is something that is preserved under the dynamics of the Hamiltonian, therefore you can distinguish two sectors. And these sectors are only distinguishable topologically, not locally, because if you want to know whether you cross an even or an odd number of states of dimers, you have to go all the way around the system. You can't just stop half the way, or you can't even just stop one dimer before you close. Right? So,
Can you remind me what the distinction now is between an electron and a hole? There are both cases where there's a U1 gauging variance here, which is the number of dimers meeting at a point.
Right.
And what you've done is, of course, if you violate that condition, you get an electron or a hole,
right,
which is a source. But now I remember there's some topological distinction between them, but I don't remember exactly how it works.
So in this particular case, there's a U1 distinction. But the issue is that the topological quantity we have here is only an easing quantity, an even or an odd.
Right.
So therefore, the only thing you're actually sensitive to is the parity of the number of defects. So it's not really U1, it's really Z2.
Well, you can make a U1 gauge transformation.
You can make a local U1 gauge transformation. It's not an Ising. You can make a U1 gauge transformation, but the low long wavelength effective theory is an Ising theory. So this is this is a rather important point that you have a local U1 gauge invariance, but basically if you try to write down a long wavelength theory, normally the way it works if you try to do the U1 gauge theory is that you'd call one direction the x direction of the electric field, the other direction the y direction, but now you've got a third direction left, and that effectively starts acting like a charge 2 Higgs scalar, and the presence of these things breaks down your U1 gauge theory to a Z2 gauge theory. So that's how things happen. So the statements here I'm making are really about long wavelength properties, low energy properties, and not about microscopic lattice scale phenomena.
So locally there's not much difference between electron and hole, but at larger distances, if you had, say, an isolated electron or an isolated hole, you can see there's something like an integral of something around a loop.
So I guess an additional electron would look like having two dimers coming out of a side, and a hole would look like this red thing I've drawn here. Okay. All right. And the reason a lot of people in quantum computing are interested in this is, of course, because these non-local degrees of freedom are moderately robust against defacing. But since that's so well known, I'm not going to say anything about it here. Okay, so as the last part of the introduction, I'd just like to say that this phase diagram here is, in fact, a bit simple. This is a property of so this particular critical point between a plaquette phase and a staggered phase is in fact a lot more complicated. This is some work that's been done a while ago also by a group here, several of the authors of which I think are present. So it turns out that you have these three phases which I had a second ago, but then between the simple plaquette phase and the staggered phase there's actually a devil staircase of other phases. And I don't think I'll have time to discuss this in any detail today, but I'd just like to point out that the Hamiltonian we're going to derive in the remainder of the talk is actually going to be one which gives you this kind of behavior with a very interesting intermediate phase rather than just the simple Roxakivelson Hamiltonian. Okay. So before I go to, what time is it? Can I borrow someone's watch perhaps? Because it's right. Thanks. So before I go to the remainder of the talk, which I'm going to do on the blackboard, I'd just like to formulate the problem I'm after for the rest of the talk. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to start with a Heisenberg. So the title of the talk was From Exotic Phases to Microscopic Hamiltonian. So I've told you about the kind of phenomena that I'd like to find a Hamiltonian for. And So the basic goals is that I'd like to find something like a topological liquid of dimers via a Heisenberg invariant Hamiltonian. And the first problem that you encounter is basically that if you want this kind of topological liquid, so the properties are it's a liquid, that means it's got only short-range correlations, is that you want to break no local symmetries, either translational or internal. So the translational symmetry breakings were these round spun solids I showed you. Internal symmetry breakings are simple, like a ferromagnet breaks the spin rotational symmetry. So for an SU2 invariant Heisenberg model, you see that in the most basic statement, you can't even get a liquid for a single spin, because if you write down any wave function, any actual wave function for a single spin, a linear combination of the up and the down state, spin a half, it always has a definite direction. And the reason for that is, of course, that spin a half does not contain the symmetric representation of the appropriate group. Really, what you need is a singlet object. And the simplest way you can get a singlet object is if you take a singlet bond between a pair of spins as a base. So for two spins, the only way of getting a singlet object is to take a singlet bond between pairs of spins. If you go to a lattice model, the simplest thing you can do, but not the only thing you can do, is take a Hilbert space, the basis of which is made up of singlet bonds between pairs of spins which are nearest neighbors. And these are what were called dimers or valence bond a second ago. So the important thing was they were spatially extended. So you can try to relax this. You can allow longer range singlet bonds. That's fine, even though that doesn't make it a lot easier. And so the reason that I'm going to be looking at models which the effective low energy Hilbert space of which is spanned by these dimer coverings is precisely because it's just easily tractable. And then the question whether you can become more general really should be answered in connection with what this buys you in terms of simplification of the model. But here I'm interested more in questions of principle, whether or not it's possible to find these appropriate phases. Okay. So can we just switch this off and put that up? Then I'll do the remainder on the blackboard. Do I put this up simply by pulling lightly, or does it? Okay. Right. Okay, so it's going to be useful to think of even the simple Heisenberg, which is a bit unusual. Sum again on nearest neighbor pairs of the vector, so L equals 1, so we have I plus I, and if the total spin is 1, then it costs you an energy 1, so it's and this is the nice property of spins. Again, this is something that you know. The dimer bond, which I was writing down, the valence bond. So this is really the motivating point for looking at these nearest neighbor dimers, at least for a cluster of size 2, that you've got the correct one state. So what goes wrong if you go to larger lattices? Well, you have to sum over all bonds. Projectors are basically competing against one another, because if you have four sides, ideally you'd like something like that. This is, of course, not possible. You have to choose either to that size like this or to that size like that. And then what happens is that instead of taking the two states, you get a combination. As you get up and up the lattice, and the coordination goes up and up. The system actually decides to make it between a diamond state at all, but so, in other words, the competition between these different objectives is so severe that the compromise to finally reach actually gets rid of the idea of a dimer altogether, and you're left with a state which breaks an internal symmetry, and this is what we'd like to avoid. So, but what we really wanted is we wanted to start with a low energy subspace with a Hamiltonian which has a low energy subspace, which is made up of containers rather than of these kind of objects. And then we'd like to perturb this to get this Roxar-Kivelson type model. The question is, even for step one, how do we do this? And so this space is too restrictive. So what's the simpler Hamiltonian which has dimer states as ground states? Well, certainly there's a Hamiltonian which is extremely simple, which all dimer states have. see that we've got a difference because, for example, this thing is also constant. So we'd like, you know, to find something which is sort of halfway between them. But really, now this sounds a bit surprising, the real difficulty is going to be a state, a local Hamiltonian, which only has dimer states as one state, and most of the work is going to be devoted to showing that there's nothing. So these projectors in the Heisenberg model don't commute. This is why it's a quantum spin model. So one thing that one might try is find projectors which commute so that you can sort of write down the wave function as a simple combination of what happens on individual bonds. This is more or less going to be a model, and this is again what we're going to do. What we're going to do is something different. We're going to write our Hamiltonian again as a sum of projectors. But the projectors are going to commute, but what they're going to do is that they're going to have a common state, a common space, which all of them annihilate, even though they don't agree what they do with excited states. So let me give you an example of that. And this is really the big insight of Klein, that this kind of thing was possible. Things are simplest. So the Heisenberg model is basically on side I and side J, K and L, and some of the three projectors. What we're now going to do is for the Klein model is introduce a projector which actually acts on side N of I and its neighborhood N of I. It's going to project on the neighborhood N of I. Contains in this case four sides, I, J, K, and L. And we're going to say if the spin L, so L is now Si, Sj, Sk, and Sl, if the total spin L equals Z over 2, it costs you some energy, and if it's less than that, it doesn't cost you any energy. So see, this has become less restrictive, because initially we said we'd like to have a dimer here, and a dimer there. And what we're saying now is we'd like to have a dimer somewhere. But a dimer somewhere, basically, think of it, yeah, dimer here, here, or there. You see that there's going to be a dimer coming out of site I. I'm going to address the question of a dimer linking sites J and L in a different context a bit later. But the important thing is that you can now see if you have a big lattice and you sum over all sites I with projectors like that, you immediately see that any dimer covering of such a lattice, in fact, is a ground state. Because provided there's a dimer coming out of this side, the total spin of these four sides is always going to be less than 2, because it's going to be at most 1 due to these sides. So with this simple trick of projecting not onto a pair of spins in the Heisenberg model, but like on a neighborhood of spins, we have drastically widened our ground state manifold. Okay, and so these things come with different prefactors, which again are something you can tune, but in a Bravais lattice they're just uniform. So what do these, what are examples of this? So one example you're very familiar with is the Bajinder-Ghosh model, at least up to a constant. It's not normally written like that, but basically you can write it, so it's a Newton. So this is Majumdar-Ghosh model is a spin chain with nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor interaction. So this is J2, this is J1. You can rewrite it. So if you draw it as a chain, it looks like that. And you know that the particular case where the ground states are dimerized is that it's the case where J1 equals 2 J2. So this is J2. And the way you can see this is basically if you take a given site and its two neighbors, and you project onto the lowest spin state, this is the same as saying, so for three neighbors, it's basically the same as saying L, for two neighbors, L squared is not allowed to be 3/2. So you call it L squared is my, So this is the sum again over all neighborhoods of side n. You can then easily show that this Hamiltonian is exactly the same one as the Majumdar-Ghosh Hamiltonian, which is conventionally written as Si dot Sj, Si plus 1 plus, sorry, 2 times the nearest neighbor, 1 plus Si times Si plus 2. So it turns out this is actually a Klein model. So here the nice thing is, what's special in the Majumdar-Ghosh model is that you still have a quadratic Hamiltonian. This is not generally the case. In fact, for the hypotenuse, the Hamiltonian is different. So the one I've written down here for the honeycomb lattice actually is just the nearest neighbor term, but then there are 2 other terms. The next nearest neighbor, and then there's a somewhat weirder term, which is a 4-spin term. And the sum here runs over nearest neighbor in J, is but not of J, and L is nearest neighbor. Okay, so this is already getting rather complicated, but the point is if you take this Hamiltonian, the one important term of which is the nearest neighbor exchange, you end up with a with a set of ground states which is exponentially large and which consists of these Diamond manifolds, which is basically this Diamond manifold. So there's a rigorous proof by Chase, and Kivelson that actually all Diamond states are ground states and only Diamond states are ground states. So this is actually what we wanted. This is something that doesn't generalize, but I'll stick to the honeycomb lattice and then tell you what to do about other lattices in a second. Okay. So now let me derive. So we've now done step one, which is find a Hamiltonian which has as its ground states the Diamond states. So that's so we started with a full spin a half on each side subspace, and we're left with a Diamond manifold. So this was my Klein model. And now what we'd like is to perturb, that is weakly, so that is to say that the perturbation should be much weaker than the prefactors appearing here, to get an effective Roxas-Kivelson quantum Diamond model. Then once we've got that, we take the results of the properties of the Roxas-Kivelson quantum Diamond model, which I presented at the beginning as given. So this is the step that we're still missing. Okay, so this goes via what's known as the overlap expansion. This is due to, I guess, originally Roxas-Kivelson in their 1988 paper. What they basically say is, what they use is the fact that different Diamond configurations are not orthogonal. So the point is that different singlets, as you know, are not orthogonal. So in particular, what you can write is that you can define an overlap matrix S, which is just the overlap of 2 different allowed dimerizations. And you can write this. You can write the matrix elements in this following notation. So if the 2 dimerizations are the same, the overlap is 1. That means it's appropriately normalized. And then you find that next higher terms look, say, on the honeycomb lattice like that. Okay, what does that mean? So that basically means if you have 2 Diamond configurations which are the same everywhere except for on a single plaquette, they differ by having that plaquette dimerized differently. This situation I denote by this symbol. Then the overlap is given by 2x to the 6th, and x is 1 over square root of 2. Okay, so this is something that you can check. It basically tells you that if 2 Diamond configurations differ by L dimers, then by L over 2 dimers, so if the loop that you get superposing these 2 has length L, then the overlap contains a factor of 2 times 1 over square root of 2 to the L. Okay, and so the way you generally compute these overlaps is you take 1 Diamond configuration you superimpose it on the other diamond configuration. So if you do this with this and that, you get a geometrical object like that. These are called loops in the transition graph. So the superposition of the two gives you what's called a transition graph. Then, say if two dimers occupy the same place, then they just erase each other. Whereas if they don't, like this, you get a loop which looks like that. And so if you sort of look back, step back a little bit, you erase all the dimers which agree, you get a soup of loops. So of course they don't just look like that because they actually live on a lattice. But the reason that a lot of these dimer models are described the same way as the loop models, which again people here in Santa Barbara have worked quite a lot on, is the fact that via this transition graph you can actually make a link between these hardcore dimers and these kind of geometrical loop configurations. Okay, so the thing now is that we'd like to derive an effective Hamiltonian which takes into account this non-orthogonality. So if I give you a perturbing Hamiltonian delta H, the form of which I'm going to write down in a second, and I'd like to know what the matrix elements is between for delta H between I and J. I can do this in an orthogonalized basis. The orthogonalized basis, the orthogonalized basis is going to be given by inverting, by using this overlap matrix. So it's called S to the minus half alpha I sum on I. And you can easily convince yourself if you multiply alpha with beta, you get basically an Sij from this I times J. And then you get two S to the minus a halves from these prefactors, and you actually do get delta alpha beta out in the end. So the overlap, the basic idea of the overlap expansion then is that you can, I've written this down, this is going to become S to the minus a half H as, so between two orthogonalized states, if you plug in this this expression, the matrix identity looks like that, where this delta H, this is alpha I, J beta. So this is something we know how to calculate because we know what the wave functions look like in the dimer basis. But then to get an orthogonalized Hamiltonian, we get these two factors as well. So details are not particularly important here, except for the fact that what you really need for this to work is a small parameter, because if you want to invert this S matrix, well, for one thing, if this parameter here is too big, then it's not going to be invertible, so that's a bad thing. But even though what we'd like to do in the end is we'd like to identify a particular orthogonalized configuration with a particular sort of dimer picture that we were writing down here. And the way you can do this basically is you think of this as an infinitesimal parameter, this x, then you can write this as delta ij, then s to the minus a half becomes delta ij minus x to the sixth times something like that. So there's going to be one configuration linking alpha and I, which has got order one, or one term which has got order one, and all the other terms are going to be small in a small parameter x. And provided you've got such a small parameter, you can identify an alpha and an I configuration. And this then basically allows you to carry over these pictures, which I showed you a second ago. You can essentially continue to think of these dimer configurations while you're actually working with orthogonal configurations. Okay, so that's the basic idea of the overlap expansion, that you use a small parameter, which is the overlap between the loops, to evaluate these kind of matrix elements. And if you do that, let me just give you one example. If you use delta H, a simple Heisenberg term, then you can just plug this in. It's some mechanical piece of work. You you basically collect the lowest order term in X, and what you find is that, let me write down the Roxar-Kivelsen Hamiltonian. The Roxar-Kivelsen Hamiltonian was, for the honeycomb lattice, looked like that. So if you add a Heisenberg term with a little j here, what you find, if you plug this into that expression, is that t is minus 3/4 times 2x to the sixth. So this is an important result, because what it tells us is that we have control over the energy scale of the perturbation in two ways. One way is if we take a small bare perturbation J. That just means if J is much less than the energy scale of the projectors, we're really doing perturbation theory within the manifold of degenerate states, and we don't have to worry about the excited states, which are a large gap away. And the other thing that turns out is that we've got a very useful handle, which is this x to the sixth. So if we actually manage to get x to be small, then this is, again, a separate way of having this perturbation to be small in the overall sense. So that's one thing. You can then write down another part of the Hamiltonian, which I'm just going to quote, to get the V term. So the Roxakivisson Hamiltonian also had this V term, which was counted the number of plaquettes which can resonate. So this is a diagonal term plus a second one. And so,
how do you get x to be small?
That's the next bit. Right. Right, yeah, that's where the messy part comes in, right? So we had the delta H to contain the J term, Si dot Sj, which I've already written here, and then you can write a V term, which is basically, so let me draw this pictorially. You have this hexagonal plaquette, and you take the product of these spin operators, so it's going to be S1 dot S2 times S3 dot S4 times S5 dot S6. This is again a multi-spin term, and then you get a second version of this just rotated by 60 degrees. Then again, you can plug this in there, and you again find that there's a that you can reproduce the V term here, which is cubed actually just times the original right, so there's actually no x term here, but the important thing is that that's going to be crucial next, is that you then get corrections, and these corrections are all down another factor of x to the fourth, again, if you work things out properly. So what's happened now? So I've written down a perturbing Hamiltonian, which looks like that, which reproduces as leading terms this one and that one. Due to the structure of this, they are independently tunable in size. And then what we find is that these are the leading terms, and then the next leading terms are further down in powers of x. Okay. So as far as the hexagonal quantum dynamo model goes, I think this is more or less the complete program. I'd like to give you one improvement related to Leon's question just now, how to actually make this a controlled expansion in X. But I think the basic ideology here now really has been just these two steps. You reduce things to the by a large energy scale to the Diamond manifold that you like, and then you take a small energy scale, you do perturbation, and then you have a small parameter, this X here, which gives you two terms and kills everything which is higher up. So to make this into a properly controlled calculation, we actually need to make this a really small parameter.
Can we go from x to the sixth to x to the fourth?
Sorry? No, so this is a further x to the fourth. Okay, so actually, so this one I think comes with x to the, no, I can't remember, x to the 10 and this one. Well, this one comes with x to the 10 and this one with something. But the important thing is that relative to the leading respective terms, this is at least an order of x to the fourth further down. Okay.
So T and V have different x dependence.
That's right, they have different x dependence, right.
So what is, I'm sorry, you have T going like x to the 6th, is that what that says?
Yeah.
And what about V?
So that actually has no leading x dependence.
No,
that comes.
The basic energy.
That's right, yeah. Okay, so the way you make x bigger is by decorating the system. So we started with something which looks like that. Right, so this is really where the limits of having a simple model become most obvious. Actually, so I add. So this is the original structure. The new structure is going to be have the original points, as well as basically tiny Majumdar Ghosh chainlets inserted in here with an even number of sites. In this case, 4. Right, you immediately see that the original dimer states like this are isomorphic to the final ones, because the way the projectors work is that if you don't have a dimer, you pair up the Majumdar Ghosh chainlets internally, and if you have a if you do have a dimer going one way, you always pair them up with a site in the end. Okay, so if you now carry everything through, if you put n sites here, what changes is that x, which used to be 1 over square root of 2, now becomes 1 over square root of 2 to the n plus 1. And so that basically means you can make, by making n large enough, you can make x as small as you like.
Look like
okay, so you basically you take this site with that one, this with that one, this with that one, this with that one.
You don't have to take
them all the way around. But nonetheless, if you decide to measure, so this is an important point, if you decide to measure your basic distance in nearest neighbor distances in the chainlets rather than in this lattice scale, then these interactions actually become something like long range. So you really shouldn't have to take m to infinity in a strict sense. Okay. How are we doing for time? Yeah.
So, in this lattice, where would you get, like, say, a repeat case?
Okay. Now I'm going to come to the triangular lattice in a second. So this is just the way where it's most simply built up, and then all the other results are just going to be able to.
Yes. Right. The question is just so when you try to confine x to be small, are you confining yourself to a certain part of the TB phase diagram?
No, that, so here I've left myself enough freedom by choosing J and V separately to go wherever I like. Okay. Okay, so the program is now internally complete in the sense that we found the low energy space, we found the correct perturbation, and we found the correct small parameter, X. Okay. One thing I haven't told you about is actually to prove that there are no other low energy degrees of freedom. As I say, in the hexagonal lattice, there's no problem. But more generally, what you have to ask yourself, even in the leading Hamiltonian, everything has got the same energy scale C. So if you have a defect, which is sort of two spin-ons in a triplet state pointing up like that, their hopping amplitude is going to be set by the same C that the gap is set by. And you really have to ask, what is the spectrum of these spin-ons which hop around? And there we've done the same kind of variational calculation that people have looked at for the Majumdar Ghosh chain with the same result. So the result being that things are gapped. The way you can see this roughly here is that, so if these, imagine these chains here are very long, then clearly inside the chain, the lowest energy states for spin-ons are spin-ons hopping around here. The thing that's different from the chains is that at these points, there's a higher coordination, and a higher coordination means that the spin-ons can gain more energy because they can hop, because they've got a higher bandwidth, because they can hop in many different directions. So there are two things you can do here. Either you make the diagonal part of the interaction so big here that this gain in kinetic energy is killed by the cost of the potential energy of actually crossing this point. But it turns out that's not even necessary. When the spin-ons instead prefer to sit here, their wave function is basically then like so. Even if you make it favorable for the spin-ons to sit here at the point of high coordination, what happens is that the wave functions decay as you go into this chain, and then the effective hopping integral between this side and that side becomes exponentially suppressed in the length of the chain. So again, things work internally consistently. Okay. So much for spin-ons. And so to come back to the original phase diagram, since we are now able to tune T and V separately, we can go through the full phase diagram. Since there are corrections, in fact, the phase diagram that you expect is not the perfect Roxakivelson phase diagram, but rather the one, the Cantor deconfined one, which I plotted as the last transparency we had there. So what happens in other lattices? Okay, so this is the groundwork more or less, and now all I'm going to do is translate this to other lattices and show what needs to be done for these individually, but if there are any questions about the general structure, you should perhaps ask them now. Okay, so on the square lattice, there's the proof of Chase, Chase, and Kivelson that all the dimer states are grounds, all ground states are dimer states does not work. So, for example, you can write down the following dimerized configuration. So again, you can see that each site and its four neighbors. Let's see, how does it go? Okay, can't remember. anyway, sorry?
Singlets are anti-symmetric.
Right, okay. So this one also turns out to be a ground state. And what in fact happens is that if you decorate, even with two sides here, then this state is no longer allowed. It's no longer an allowed ground state, then everything goes through exactly like here. So all the all the square lattice quantum dimer stuff is just identical to the hexagonal lattice. Things get a bit worse for the triangular lattice because here you can see that you can take 1/3 of the sides of the triangular lattice and dimerize the remaining hexagonal lattice, and then obviously in this side and its neighborhood there is always quite a few dimers, so this is also going to be a dimerized ground state. But again, if you decorate the lattice, these go away and everything works exactly the same way as before. The other one important observation here is that since the triangular RVB phase is gapped, the fact that you've got corrections here is not a particularly severe limitation, because as long as the corrections are small compared to the gap, and they can be made small thanks to the decoration procedure, you're guaranteed that you can actually get a stable topological RVB phase out of this kind of Hamiltonian. So if you really have an SU2 invariant Hamiltonian on a weakly decorated triangular lattice, which in a pretty controlled way you can have confidence in possessing an topological RVB liquid phase. Okay, are there any undecorated lattices where the same thing may work? So I'm grateful to Chris Henley for pointing out a lattice where, which has got a very nice properties for this. From this perspective. So this turns out to be the dual of the Shastri-Sutherland. Looks like that. So it's a lattice which is only made up of pentagons, but not of equivalent pentagons. The shortest closed loop of even length you can have, I think, is length 8, which is a good thing because it makes the convergence parameter rather large. And everything I said can be done here exactly the same way that, even without decoration as in the other models. So if I had to give you some lattice which are sort of close to what we're familiar with, I think this would perhaps be our best bet. Okay. So just to give you an idea what the important things were, so the important things were that you had to have low coordination, because low coordination is a good thing when you want to stabilize dimer states against against Néel states, and then you want long closed loops because you want to have the beneficial value of the order parameter. So you can do the same thing in the FCC lattice in 3D, and then you get an easing deconfined topological phase in three dimensions. And you can do the same thing in the diamond lattice in 3D. If you do that, you get yet a different phase. So I can't draw the diamond lattice, I'm afraid. The basic distinction between the FCC and the diamond lattice is that whereas the FCC lattice is not bipartite, the diamond lattice is, so it's got this, it's got coordination 4, something like that. So here's a side in the diamond lattice. Each side on the A sub lattice is linked to 4 sides on the B sub lattice. So you can again write down exactly the same kind of Klein-Hamiltonian. You can decorate it, you can perturb it, and what you find then is what's known as a U1 liquid. And I'm sorry I don't have time to describe that in the amount of detail it merits, but what you essentially find is that the spin correlations, the singlet correlations decay algebraically, so like 1 over R cubed. But nonetheless, it's a stable extended phase. And then you've got as low energy excitations, you have photonic excitations, that is to say, you've got transverse excitations with a linear dispersion. And these you can think of essentially as density waves of these basic Dymer degrees of freedom. Okay, so since an hour is over now, I'm not going to inflict the Pyroclaw results on you, but I'd be happy to discuss them privately with anyone who wants to know. So just to summarize, in the first part of the talk, I've tried to give you a very brief summary on the kind of new phases that have cropped up in connection with an effort to understand these singlet-dominated phases arising in correlated electrons, restorated magnets, and described by the Roxack-Hilversum quantum Dymer model. In the second part, I've tried to convince you that, as a matter of principle, there's nothing stopping you from taking SU2 invariant model and by exclusively analytical means demonstrating that these phases are actually stable phases, which are properties of these models. And then finally, I think where this should go next is to restrict oneself to slightly less outlandish geometrical constructions and ask what are the simplest actual Hamiltonians, the phases of which are continuously connected to the phases of interest here. Thanks for your attention. Yeah?
Suppose you take a realistic isomer Hamiltonian where everything doesn't work quite so nicely. Would you, you could expect some kind of approximate dimerization. So you get an effective theory with spinons and holons or dynamical spinons and holons? Anybody thought about what you'd actually get?
So I guess coming from the other way, you can ask about the instabilities of the phases I've talked about here. And certainly the kind of questions to ask are what happens when the spin-on gap collapses, for example. So a natural thing to happen might then, for example, be a spinful state, like a Néel-type ground state or spiral-type state. These would be relatively natural things to come out of this. But as soon as you have this kind of phenomenon, I presume that you'd probably get some local symmetry breaking, then that you'd be in business with the normal methods we have of analyzing local symmetry broken states, like Landau theory and all that. These are very interesting phenomena, but the reason for doing this is primarily to understand things which lie beyond there. And then, of course, there's an interesting question, how does this connect back to what we know better? And that's probably the way it does. Well, as I say, you can do the search for more realistic systems, for example, using cold atoms. But I think if I would, if I had listened to the general state of the art a few years ago and told people to look for these kind of phases, a lot of them would have said, well, these phases simply don't exist. Now I think we can be very confident that they exist, and if I were experimentally to implement some proposal which is supposed to realize one of them, I think would give me a little bit of confidence that I'm looking for something that at least in principle is there.
Yeah, the mushroom de Gauche model can be easily made.
Right, okay. See? Okay, so I think I'd stop here.